What if you succeeded? What if you fell so far, so deep, that no one thought you could be found or saved, and they all left you? But against all odds, you found a foothold, and you started to climb. What if you kept climbing, and people started to notice? People started to approve of what you're doing, enjoy what you're doing, and cheer you on. And what if you climbed so high, you climbed higher than from where you fell, and you kept climbing, and people were cheering you on because every step you took was more and more successful? And then what would happen if you reached the top? If you succeeded, if you defied everyone's expectation, and you looked around, and there's no place else to go? What would you do then? How could you go further? What other frontier would you try to find? I'm Mike McCafferty, and tonight we're going to be talking about what happened to Star Trek when they did the unthinkable, when they searched for God, and they found Shatner. Isn't this great music? One of the things I regret is overlooking Jerry Goldsmith's scores. And if you want to listen, you can hear in one of the previous episodes how much I overlooked that as I looked at all the different themes from Star Trek. I'm going to stop this music here. I don't have a producer, mind you, so I'm just doing this as a one-man band. I'm playing the music right off the movie, right into the computer. I'm hearing a slight echo in my head, so if I seem a little distracted at times, that's what's going on. It's not me calculating how I'm going to talk about Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, to you in our great movie dive of the summer of 2019. I found this movie dive to be more difficult than some of the other ones. The other ones I had a fairly strong grasp on, even the first movie, because I had seen them either in the theaters or, well, I'd seen them all in the theaters, except this one. And so I understood how to approach them all because I've been thinking about them before, 40 or 35 or 30, or as we even go forward up to 5 years ago when I saw Star Trek Beyond at San Diego Comic-Con. But Star Trek V is a different beast because I'm approaching it from something from a different place. But be that as it may, let's talk a little bit about Star Trek V. Let's deep dive into it and figure out what this movie is, because I don't think it knows what it is. All right, I'm going to my notes now. The best thing we can say about Star Trek V overall is it has the best Roman numeral as far as a title. That big V standing out in the middle of nowhere looks great. It's too bad they didn't use, like, Star Trek X for one of their movies, because that'd be, like, the other good one. Although that'd have, like, kind of allusions to Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, which we'll talk about in a little while. But Star Trek V: The Final Frontier has a pretty good title. And it certainly begs the question, what is this final frontier? Now, certainly it is invoked, as we know, space, the final frontier. But what does that mean? Well, we're going to figure that out. Now, oddly enough, this is one of the movies, besides Star Trek II, that I have talked about the most. As odd as that may seem, it's been kind of a curiosity for me, because it has been a film which I never saw in the theaters. I admit it. I want to talk about Star Trek. I did not see this in the theaters. But if you want to go back and hear some reference podcasts, you can listen to episode 113, where we go to Yosemite. And we look at El Capitan, and we talk with the fools, my friends, about the experience. We watched the movie. Episode 111, where I think I talk about the movie music. Talk about the isn't that a great theme? Isn't that just so beautiful? It says Kirk is climbing El Capitan. And then, if you really want to, probably the best one of the three is go back to episode 13, where we have a talk with Lawrence Luckinbill, who is great in this. So that's your homework if you want to do it. If not, as reference material, don't worry about it. All right, so we're going to start in three different parts. We'll talk about the pre-production of it. We'll talk about the movie itself, and we'll talk about my thoughts afterwards. All right, I'll try to keep it under a certain amount of time because I know you're busy people and you've got rocks to climb. Go climb a rock. Remember when Shatner had that shirt on that he boldly pulled his jacket open so we could all read it for like 15 minutes? It says, "Go climb a rock" in that scene. That did not catch on. That was not merchandisable clothes to wear. Star Trek IV was an unprecedented hit in the Star Trek franchise. Finally, after 77 episodes, 76 episodes, and three movies, what we all knew as Star Trek fans had finally come to pass. That Star Trek, yes, was something that could cross over into the mainstream. It was something which everyone could enjoy. You didn't have to be a sci-fi fan. You could be anybody and enjoy the heck out of that film. And they did. It made like $102 million, which back in 1986 was a lot of money. It was a lot of money. It doesn't crack the top 100. I went back and checked, even adjusted for inflation. I think Star Trek 2009 and Star Trek The Motion Picture have cracked the top 100. But that's just because of re-releases and stuff like that. Well, I don't want to get into that. So Star Trek IV was a huge hit. And now Paramount has a franchise on their hands. They don't know what to do. This should not have happened. This was a big mistake followed up by having one chip left and putting it on black in the casino and it hits and then they double down again and all of a sudden they are richer. They are more wealthy than Avarice's dreams. What does he say in Star Trek IV? I always remember that. Forget that, what McCoy says. But anyways, they have found themselves with an unexpected franchise. What are they going to do? They have endless possibilities and they have mainstream appeal. Finally, we have got to protect this. Think about franchises now like Harry Potter or James Bond or all the Marvel films, how carefully they cultivate these each movie so that it becomes an event, so it becomes a thing you have to see. There's inevitability. Think about Fast and Furious. All of these franchises, everything you go to see now is a franchise. But back then, franchises were still things which were, you know, not really looked at since the days of the 40s with The Thin Man and Abbott and Costello and all those kind of films which are just kind of like, let's make another because we can make some money because everyone goes to see the movie theater films every week. But the 80s were the rebirth of the franchise. And as you had Rocky and Jaws and the James Bond film coming back, what do we do with this? Well, for whatever fortune you may place upon it, because fortune favors the foolish, they had a little recourse with what to do with Star Trek V. They had to hand it over to William Shatner. Favored Nations. Now, before we go on, chronologically, I must tell you that a friend of mine, Eddie Jones, who is in The Invisible Man, the TV show I was on, passed away a couple days ago. And he was a great friend and a great actor, Rocketeer, A League of Their Own, Sneakers, Adventures of Lois and Clark, and the TV show is in The Invisible Man, and a good friend. And I miss him already, and it makes me sad that I didn't even spend more time with him. But one of the things, the reason I bring this up, is because when we were going to negotiate for our third season contracts, I was going to ask for what Shatner and Nimoy had asked for way, way back in the 60s, which was Favored Nation. We've talked about this before. We talked about this many times, that they had gone in and in order not to fight against themselves, said whatever one gets, the other one gets. Brilliant strategy. I don't know who else does this anymore, but they did it back in the 60s. And so whatever one got, the other got. So Star Trek III, Nimoy directs, which means that Bing Shatner gets to direct. Star Trek IV, they put Shatner off and said, okay, we want Nimoy to do this one. We want to make it his film. And in addition to him directing, he got to write it as well. Bing, bing, writer and director. And now, the piper must be paid. And now, you have to turn to William Shatner because contractually, he is obliged to write and direct a film. And so now your franchise, which is slowly arising from that, it's a climbing El Capitan of financial success, has this hurdle in William Shatner. What are you going to do? well, contractually have to do it. And in fact, if you watch the press conference, there's, and I'll post this on our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page if you haven't checked it out. And it's worth it because we always post all sorts of additional stuff. I'll post this. It is a hilarious press conference on the last day of filming for Star Trek V. And someone asks why they let him direct it, William Shatner. And he bluntly says, well, they were contractually obligated to let me direct it. So there we go. And then he laughs at William Shatner has a weird fake laugh. When he really laughs, he giggles like a girl. It's like, but when he fake laughs, it's lower. It's like, I'm fascinated by it. Listen for it. But this press conference is great because he forgets Walter Koenig's name. He forgets, I think, DeForest Kelly. I think he's so nervous. He turns to Walter Koenig, Helmsman? And Walter Koenig takes the microphone and he says, Walter Koenig, like, you don't know that, Bill Shatner? After 20 years, you don't know my damn name? It's pretty funny. I'll post it in the Facebook page. But they had to. They had no choice but to allow him to not only direct it, but to write it too. Can you imagine another franchise now in 2019 where they would just hand over the keys to the kingdom like that? Even Robert Downey Jr. Here, Robert Downey Jr., direct Avengers 5. Good luck. You get to write it too. Here, Rupert Gint, is that his name? From Harry Potter. Here, go ahead. Write and direct the next Harry Potter film. I think I messed that up, didn't I? It doesn't matter. I think that guy's in Homeland. It's unprecedented. But again, this is the 80s. And so a lot of this codification of how to make franchises has not yet been established. And because they were hemmed in by this. Now, what they should have done, what Paramount should have done, said, you know what, Bill? You know, Nimoy has directed some episodes of TV. We know you directed some TJ Hookers. We get that. Can we give you another movie right now? And we promise you, we will give you a Star Trek movie down the line. But they didn't have that kind of thought, foresight to do it. So for better or for worse, depending on your interpretation of these things, Shatner was allowed to write and direct. The studio mandated they keep the tone light in light of Star Trek IV being so wonderful, light, bouncy, and fun to an audience. Let's keep that going. Keep it light. Keep it bouncy. Shatner wanted to find God. If you go through the Bible, it's generally not that funny. And so already we have a problem. Shatner had an idea that he wanted to find God. And then this God, whatever it was, would actually turn out to be the devil. And then at the end, we'd realize that the God and devils are really the ones that are inside our heart. Very noble, very interesting, very difficult to pull off. I did a lot of reading on this, and most of the screenwriters who took a part of this or anyone said, you can't find God. Now, we've found gods before in Star Trek. Apollo. Apollo is a god, and he out and out says, yes, I was on Earth a long time ago. But he's not the god. He's not the god of an actual continuing functioning religion. You know, for like 3 billion people. That's a tough one to pull off. And keep it light. Go ahead and try that. Gene Roddenberry also had a very similar idea to this. A movie called The God Thing. And also something called In Thy Image as well. Both of these sort of, and also another film called Star Trek The Motion Picture. Towards the end of his life, at least there's a middle part of Gene Roddenberry's life where he is searching for God. We also saw it in The Changeling, in the original series. And he actually told Shatner about this idea 10 years earlier. He pitched it to him as he was working on an adaptation of his The God Thing for Star Trek. Shatner sort of cops to saying, I might have taken a little bit of what he said there, but either way, it hurt Roddenberry. It kind of put a little bit of a rift between them. Roddenberry, whose power had already been stripped since the first Star Trek, after his first swing in it, which was a disaster. And say what you will about Star Trek V, but at least it has more coherent action set pieces and more characters you understand than Star Trek I, which was a meander because they were writing it as they went. But Roddenberry was on to other things, and we'll talk about that in a little while. Shatner was not the best choice for a director, no matter what. Shatner is a spontaneous actor. He is an actor who is bold, who boldly goes when he acts. But that's not the best choice for a director sometimes. Now, sometimes it works out. Like someone maybe like Adam McKay or Steven Spielberg, who can get on the set and say, okay, what do we got here? Okay, let's put this together with this, this, and this. But those guys, they've been thinking about directing or comedy all of their lives. You're asking someone who had not worked on directing at all in his life, not thought about it, suddenly being thrust into it. Now, Leonard Nimoy, as a contrast, is a thoughtful actor and a thoughtful person, a person who carefully considers what his choices are. There's the famous stories about him in the original series about always being in character. My God, how annoying would that be? While Shatner was always like, you know, floating around, making jokes, laughing all the time, having a great time, good for morale, not great as far as picking out camera shots or coming up with a script and really thinking about it and really considering it moment by moment by moment. Shatner also, as a newbie director, didn't realize that you need to really pick your battles as far as where the budget goes. And one of the mistakes he made was to make sure he got his Yosemite shots. But in the end, when it came time for the big third act, he didn't have any money left. And so he lost his rock monsters. And we'll talk about that later too. It's interesting. It is interesting that, I'm reading my notes here. I'm reading this note here about Walter Koenig. I apologize for that. I don't necessarily blame Shatner for all of these mistakes. Again, he's a new guy. He wants this stuff. He is so passionate about this stuff. We talked about it before in the previous episodes where he wants to be in every scene. He wants to do everything. And so, of course, he wants to direct. Of course, he wants to write. He's a happy little puppy who wants these things. And Walter Koenig, who he didn't remember his name, even admits that he wanted to make a good film. And we couldn't not have him in the film. We couldn't cut him out of this film. He's Captain Kirk. So what are your choices? He has to write and direct this one. Okay. Finding God, as I said, is problematic. Indiana Jones and Last Crusade, in fact, all the Indiana Jones films had some sort of theme of finding God. But generally, it's finding some sort of artifact. Finding God as a side story was always sort of a result of it. We have to find this cup. We have to find, you know, this ark. We have to find these stones. And then, guess what? There's like ghosts and stuff floating around. Maybe there's God. Who knows? But we don't have to worry about that. We got our cup. We got our ark. We got our stones. This was an out-and-out search for God via the main character, who was not Captain Kirk. But Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and Star Trek V did almost share something in common, that being Sean Connery. Sean Connery was pursued to play Cybok in Star Trek V. And in fact, as an inside joke, as Cybok is searching for Shakari, that is actually a play on words for Sean Connery. So the next time you say Sean Connery, say Sean Connery instead of Shakari. Or just call him Shakari. But of course, he turned that down in order to take Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where instead of going to find God, he goes to find the cup of Christ. So, you know, what are you going to do with that? This film, this script, shares a similar flaw with Star Trek, the motion picture, in that from a script perspective, and we'll talk about this as we get into the actual scripting, our main characters do nothing. They are pulled along as though in a boat. Just as in Star Trek, the motion picture, they are not the leads of their own film. They're on some sort of dark ride in Disney where they're being pulled along, and what they do and what they don't do doesn't necessarily have a big effect. It's interesting because Raiders of the Lost Ark has that similar problem, where Indiana Jones is sort of pulled along through all these things, and really if you take him out of the equation, there's a good chance the Ark might still end up in the hands of a museum, of an American museum. But for some reason that worked, and one of the reasons is because they had Steven Spielberg as director. All right. The other thing I want to point out here is that as opposed to Star Trek 1 through 4, Star Trek 5 now had competition. The Next Generation was in production. The first season are aired. And as they're airing, as they are filming this, season 2 is being filmed. And when they release this film, they're actually airing episodes of Next Generation. So they're actually competing against themselves. With Gene Roddenberry, as executive producer of that show, who is miffed at William Shatner for stealing his idea. So even though, same company, theoretically the same goals, there's some beef there. All right. Let's move on to part two, the actual film. Buckle in. Let's do it. Now, we've talked about this film a couple of different times in a couple of different ways, but I'm going to do it this process as I've done it before. We start out actually somewhat promising. We have weirdo-looking guy Rex Holman, who played Morgan Earp in the original series episode The Spectre of the Gun, as a kind of a dashing-looking cowboy, now playing this bald-headed, strange dental fixtures guy sitting out in the middle of the desert digging holes. He's digging holes for some reason, and they never explain why. But that's what he does. And then a weird, mysterious figure looks like Obi-Wan Kenobi on a horse. William Shatner loves horses. Starts riding up to him as he's digging these holes with smoke coming out of him. What the hell is he digging these holes for? And crazy, weird Rex Holman pulls out his strange gas-powered pebble gun and points it at this guy. And the guy says, why are you defending these holes in there? He even calls it these holes in the ground. And Rex, I don't know his character's name, but he just says, it's all I have. And then this character sort of does this strange thing where he releases his pain. He releases Rex Holman, alien's pain. And the guy cries, he sobs. And then the mysterious figure says, we're going to get a starship. And then the Rex Holman character says, you can't get a starship here on Nimbus 3. And then we reveal that this guy is actually a Vulcan. And he starts laughing. He starts laughing a lot. Now, a side note here. As we were driving back from Chico, California, to go see my mother recently, as I was doing my deep dive kind of fact-finding information about this movie, I said, Kiernan, do you want to watch Star Trek V as we drive down? You watch it, and I'll listen to it on the car speakers so I can listen to it, and you can watch it. He said, yeah, sure, Dad. And the first thing he asked was, why is that Vulcan laughing? I'm like, oh, you know, this is actually a pretty good teaser then. Cold open, because we don't know. None of us know what's going on. Who is this Vulcan, and why is he laughing? Because Vulcans don't laugh. Good job. The other part of this story is that about 40 minutes into this film, he asked if we could stop it. He said it was boring. So, there you go. All right. Let's see. Where am I going to go here? All right. So, we've already established we cut from there to this beautiful segment of William Shatner scaling El Capitan. Now, if you haven't seen the movie Free Solo, me and the doctor saw it last year. And it is both beautiful and terrifying. It is the actual, real story of the first guy to free solo up El Capitan, this almost straight, vertical, like featureless rock in Yosemite. We've talked about it before a little bit in the in some of the other podcasts. It is next to impossible. And yet here we have Captain Kirk, probably like a 50-something-year-old man, climbing up this rock. We've never seen him climb rocks before, maybe Vasquez rocks, but that's at a 45-degree angle. And yet here he is, effortlessly scaling this rock. He's got all the gear. He's doing it. But if you want to lose an audience quickly, that's a good way of doing it. Because no matter how many starships and people turning into rock monsters and whatever you want to put in there, if it doesn't logically work out for someone, even the smallest detail, the audience will know. The audience will ask about that. But there he is, climbing up. He's climbing up, doing a pretty damn good job. He's almost halfway up. And then who shows up but Mr. Spock in ski boots. Mr. Spock in ski boots, which are actually rocket boots, and he's floating up there. And already we've got even more issues. because Spock is being a jackass, as he knows how hard this is for Captain Kirk to climb this mountain. It's the hardest thing. As a side note, I should say the guy who actually did climb El Capitan, there's a video of him kind of rating other movies of people climbing mountains. And this one, he gives it a pretty good mark. He says this is actually pretty realistic. Now, here's one of the first big problems of this film. Spock says, "Why are you climbing this rock?" And Kirk says, "Because it's there." I'm not 100% buying that. I'm having a little bit of a problem with that. And I'll go into that a little bit more. And I wish we and I'll tell you of a different version of this film later on. But because it's there is such a pat, trite answer that really it serves nothing. We all know that answer. Why climb it? Because it's there. We don't see movies for trite answers. We want to learn something different. The next thing that happens is that Kirk falls. Spock goes ass over teacup, as they call it, tea kettle, and his legs shoot up comically as though he's on some sort of balance beam, and he shoots straight down to try and catch Captain Kirk, William Shatner, in front of a terrible green screen, although there's a guy, if you see in the end credits, I don't remember his name, who does the longest free fall in the United States. They had a guy actually fall off of El Capitan, and they filmed him, and then he fell into some sort of bags or something like that, or whatever it is. And it's a spectacular fall, once again marred by a terrible green screen of William Shatner falling. Spock catches him inches from the ground. There we are. That's that scene. We go back to Nimbus 3. And once again, Star Trek tries to approximate a Star Wars bar. We have this bar in Nimbus 3 at the hometown of Nimbus 3, Paradise, which someone has cleverly painted Paradise Lost. Oh, the literary allusions to that. My God. Out here in the desert. And there are people playing water pool, which is just, it looks like they just submerged a pool table. There's a three-breasted Catwoman dancing on a table. I kid you not. It took her 5 hours to get into the makeup and 5 hours to get out, and she danced like she's on screen for like 50 seconds total. There's some weird guy on the TV screen basically entreating people to show up to Nimbus 3. Nimbus 3 is an interesting idea, though. And we have our first sort of tease of that with Caitlin Dar, who is a Romulan, which I believe is our first look at a Romulan. And she shows up, and Nimbus 3 is a place where the Klingons and the Romulans and the Federation have all agreed to meet. So like a Geneva kind of place, a place where you all go, and it's a planet of peace. And she shows up there with high expectations, but no one really cares. It has been a failure. After 20 years, it's a giant failure. And we will never hear about Nimbus 3 again. But we have Caitlin Dar, we have General Cord with two R's, and St. John Talbot, played by David Warner, who will play another character in the next movie, and no one seems to mind about that. In fact, Nicholas Meyer, who cast him in the next movie, didn't even realize he was in this movie when he cast him. That's fine. Because none of this matters. Nimbus 3 has zero impact upon this film. And that's too bad, because it's an interesting idea. But they'll reuse that later on. We'll talk about that. All right, I want to go to this. As I said before, let me pull this up. What am I pulling? Here we go.
Lump of rock.
What possible value could we be to you?
Nimbus 3 may be a worthless lump of rock, but it does have one unique treasure. It's the only place in the entire galaxy that has the three of you.
I don't know who you are or what you want, but I can tell you this. Our governments will stop at nothing to ensure our safety.
That's exactly what I'm counting on.
Except they don't. Nobody really goes to find them except the Federation. This Romulan or the Klingons... three ambassadors are kidnapped, and only the Federation really wants to do anything. All right, so the next thing we have is we have the campfire scene. This has been a much maligned scene, and by the writer's own admission, he just wanted to have a wonderful character scene in the middle of the film. Just three people hanging out. Now, I remember when I watched Star Trek The Next Generation and watched them play poker, and I thought, you know, I could watch about an hour of these Next Generation people just playing poker and doing nothing else. And I just, because you want to be part of this. You want to have that sort of fan fiction-y experience. And if that was a bonus section, that would be great. But in a film where every scene matters, to have a scene about nothing, about characters just hanging out, doesn't really work. It could have been something. See if I can find that part. All right, why don't you listen to this part? All right, so they're all around the campfire. Dr. McCoy has served his beans, ringing his bell too loud.
And even as I fell, I knew I wouldn't die.
Oh, I thought he was the only one who's immortal.
Oh, no, it isn't that. I knew I wouldn't die because the two of you were with me.
I do not understand.
I've always known. I'll die alone.
Well, call the Holland and have them reserve a room for you. This mystery to me what draws us together. All that time and space and getting on each other's nerves. And what do we do when shore leave comes along? We spend it together. Other people have families.
Other people don't, not us.
That's a nice scene. Again, if you look at Star Trek V in totality, it's kind of a mess. When you break it down scene by scene, there are moments which are little gems, and that's one of them. Where the three of them have this realization that they are career men, that no matter what, they always come back to this. As I said before, I feel as though there's missed opportunities with Captain Kirk's storyline here. At first, when they ask him why he's climbing the mountain, he says, because it's there. And then here he says, I always know I'll die alone. But why do we climb mountains? Why do we go to these final frontiers? To me, it feels as though he's searching for something more. As he should be searching for God, as we all sort of, as we get older, as we search for God, as we search for meaning in our own lives, we find him at a point in his life where he has everything he sort of wanted. And so what is beyond? What is that final frontier? I wish we would have had more regret with him here. I wish he wouldn't have just said, not us, Bones. I wish he would have lamented about these things. I have a pitch for how this movie could have gone. I'll tell it to you later in the third part. But I just want to point out that while this is a beautiful scene, it immediately gets ruined by Spock pulling out this weird lightsaber thing and pulling out a marshmallow. Very
preparing to toast a marshmallow. I'll be there. A marshmallow.
And that was actually part of an earlier scene, marshmallow.
Before leaving the ship, I
not a marshmallow.
The library, familiarize myself with the customs associated.
So we pull back from that scary moment there where we could have deep introspection from Captain Kirk, and instead
consume them.
Roast marshmallows.
Consume them. I mean, after that. Oh. I believe we are required to engage in a ritual known as the sing-along.
Singing songs.
I haven't sung around a campfire since I was a boy in Iowa.
And we shouldn't have you sing again. Now, I have to say that if you pick anybody else in this universe to sing, William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly are probably not the three you should have as your first three. They should be your last three. Pick anybody else. Because they go through a rendition of Row, 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 Row Your Boat, which is really rough. I mean, William Shatner, by his own admission, is probably tone deaf. Leonard Nimoy aspires to be a better singer than he is, and I've never heard DeForest Kelly sing, and I don't think I heard him sing it in this movie either. It's a nice attempt. But again, I'll also point out that this song is sort of thematic with what this movie is. They're on a boat going down a stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. They can't do anything about it, and they don't do anything about it. They just sail along in it. All right. Oh, listen to this.
Walter, what are we going to say?
How about Camptown Races?
Pack up your troubles.
Are we leaving, Captain? It's a song title, Spock.
Moon over Rigel 7.
Moon over Rigel 7. It's Rigel. It's Rigel. We've called it Rigel for a long time. It's in the original series. It's in future episodes. It's Rigel, not Rigel. It's Rigel. Just had to point that out. Meanwhile, we have a subplot of a Klingon named Kla. Star Trek IV, as we remember, has a bounty on Kirk's head. And so this Klingon, this random Klingon, decides to... We see him first blowing up a Voyager probe because it's really, really difficult. It's not difficult. It's just floating out in space. They blow it up. And then he finds out that... well, later on, he's going to find out that Kirk is going to be in the picture. He's going to want to hunt him down. But this is a weird space here for Klingons. And here's why. Because originally, Klingons in the original series start off as these sort of space Nazis. They were just kind of like the bad guys. They were insidious, but they were smart. They were calculating. Essentially, they were Nazis in space. When the movies came along, they became sort of space pirates. They were kind of undefined in the first movie. In Star Trek III, we kind of made them more like space pirate kind of guys. But by the time the Next Generation came along, which it had already happened the first season, and we have... Commander Worf, Lieutenant Commander Worf, or Lieutenant Worf, I should say, on the Enterprise, they began to reshape them from space Nazis to space pirates to space samurai, where they have more honor. Again, I told you before that I was always upset that they sort of took the honor portion of the Romulans in the original series and gave it to the Klingons, but it made them far more interesting than just like screaming crazy space pirates, which is what they were in Star Trek III. So here we have this Klingon who is still sort of a space pirate, but we know that there's another version out there that is literally playing against them that is going to be far more interesting. All right, so we go back to the Enterprise. They are beamed up because there's a Priority 1 alert, and the Enterprise is a mess again. Remember in Star Trek 1 when they could barely put it together? Now they rebuilt the Enterprise, Enterprise 171-A, for our gallant crew, but it's still a mess. Why would you build a ship that's a mess? But it is a huge mess, and Scotty is running around with a giant wrench and said, use the right tools for the right job, blah, blah, blah. None of the doors work. Everything, like, who... What is the Federation if they're launching these goofball ships? Well, they're a terrible Federation because they have no other ships in the area. Once again... Just like in Star Trek 1, there's no other ships in the area that can possibly save Earth. They can possibly save Earth! All right. We get to the major conflict here at the 29-minute mark. And we have this guy telling us about it. Melanie Shatner, Kirk's Shatner's daughter, is in the film.
Can you clear that up?
She takes his jacket.
Can we have a little quiet? Bob?
Jim?
Well, we're dressing informally, aren't we?
You caught me on the way to the shower.
Well, I apologize for canceling shore leave, but look, we have a dangerous situation out on Nimbus 3.
On the planet of galactic peace?
The same. From all we can make out, a terrorist force has captured the only settlement, and they've taken hostages. The Klingon, the Romulan, the Federation Councils. Now, I know Enterprise is not exactly up to specs.
With all due respect, the Enterprise is a disaster. There must be other ships in the Quadrant.
Other ships, yes. But no experienced commanders. Captain, I need Jim Kirk.
We need a better actor for that, don't we? That is actually Harv Bennett, the executive producer of many of these Star Trek films. And he's delivering a performance as though he's doing the Masters on CBS on Sunday. or doing a Jack Parr imitation to go way back, or Steve Allen. It is such a low key, like, we've got problems on Nimbus 7. I need Jim Kirk. There's no stakes or tension in this. Three ambassadors have been captured. And this is one of those places where this could have been a really, really cool problem. We've got three different ambassadors from the three major superpowers in the galaxy. This could be a giant powder keg. And we're going to send our best to get them. But instead, you've got this rickety ship which is barely functioning, and he says, maybe there's other ships in the quadrant. No, there are, but I need my Jim Kirk. Then put him on a better ship. Don't put him on a ship that doesn't work. There should be other ships around there. And jumping ahead. They take the mission, of course. They have no choice but to take the mission. And
on screen,
Kirk looks at who's been captured.
General Kord.
Sam, he's apparently fallen out of favor with the Klingon High Command.
General Kord's military strategies were required learning when I was a cadet at the Academy. When they put me out to pasture, I hope I fare better than Kord.
That could have been a major interesting plot line to this film. Again, as we see Captain Kirk climbing a rock because it's there, not because it's there, as he laments the fact that he may die alone, that he's a career man, there's nothing else for him. He stepped down from being an admiral to doing the one thing he wanted to do, which would be a captain, but as V'ger asks, is that all there is? Is there nothing more? When you reach a certain age, you start to ask these questions, and then you start to look a little further ahead, because you know at some point in time they're going to put you out to pasture. And here, Captain Kirk sees Captain Kord, or General Kord, and he laments, I hope they don't do that to me when they put me out to pasture. He does a terrible line reading of that. This should have been the most terrifying thing to Captain Kirk right then and there. He's finally got everything he wants back, and now this is what he's afeared of the most. Being parked somewhere at the back end of the galaxy to just rot away and die. But instead, it becomes a shrug. Just as most of this plotline becomes a shrug. Because no one really cares about this plotline, because all it is a setup to get them on to the real plotline, which is to find Cyborg. Now, of course, Spock sees Cyborg right off the bat when they have one of the message sent to them. And he omits telling Kirk and McCoy that it is his half-brother. They go to the captain's lounge, which, by the way, looks pretty badass, right? If out of all the sets they've built, this captain's lounge, which has the nice ship wheel there, pretty good. He omits to say that. I don't know why he does that, but he does. They launch a rescue mission, and Uhura, dear sweet Nichelle Nichols, does a naked fan dance. And there's nothing wrong with that. What is wrong is it's just the dumbest thing. It makes no sense. As Chekhov is playing Captain.
Protect me. In the meantime, Captain Chekhov, I instruct you and your first officer to beam down to my coordinates.
You'll be happy to beam down. But first, we must have certain assurances.
All right, meanwhile.
At foot speed, I estimate the journey to Paradise City at 1.2 hours.
We don't have one.
It looks like a casino, by the way. They look.
Wait a minute. Perfect.
They see some blue horses. Guarded by guys. There's a dude drinking water from, like, a roof or something. He's kneeling by a fire. He says, what? And then, we see Nichelle Nichols singing by two gigantic moons, which would totally destabilize the orbit of the planet.
Damn.
One man says, damn. Is she naked?
Is she naked?
All these men are enthralled by this naked woman dancing with palm fronds, and they leave their post They say, "Woman!" And they climb up this sand dune. Chattering excitedly. Until finally, when they get to the top, smiling, happy.
Hello, boys. I've always wanted to play to a captive audience.
Oh, my. Oh, my. This was supposed to be a joke, as presented by the screenwriter, but the producers liked it so much they put it in there. And to the credit, it's nice that Nichelle Nichols gets to do something in this film. Now, she was like a Broadway caliber singer. She sang, she was in Dreamgirls. She backed up a lot of great singers. She, in her time, was great. But this is not the right time to do a fan dance. And even worse, they replaced her vocals with another woman's voice in this. So all you have is these goofball dudes on Nimbus 3 who are all rushing towards this naked woman with intent of I don't know what, only to be suckered in to surrendering so that Kirk and Spock can get blue horses and ride to this strange casino in the middle of the desert. That's not a good scene. That's a bad scene. We don't like that scene. But Shatner loves horses. They get to Nimbus 3, to Paradise. They have the battle. The battle is bananas. Spock neck pinches a blue horse. It reminds me of Blazing Saddles when Mongo punched a horse. Kirk fights the cat girl, who has screams. The cat girl's screams are actually from James Brown screaming during some of his songs, like I Feel Good. Wow! Wow! I feel good! Wow! Listen to it. You will hear it. He throws Cat Girl in the water pool. There are all sorts of crazy stunts in there. It's quite exciting. It's better than the motion picture at this point in time. And for the first of many times to come, their plan fails. They go in there and they're captured by Cybok. Now, this is when we improper meet Lawrence Luckenbill's Cybok. He is, I've talked about this many times before, he is the star of this film. He is the only person that is truly fully invested in this character. Everyone else is sort of sleepwalking through it or don't have a solid grasp on it because the script isn't strong enough. But he, as the main character, as who has the strongest want in this film, the strongest need, is being pulled along by this at every moment. He's the first main character we see in this film. This is his film. And he's good. In fact, I just wrote him an email today before I went off and did this. I said, hey, I just want to let you know it's been 3 years since we've talked. Still a damn good performance. Now, there's a long sequence as they steal the shuttlecraft, and they still can't use the transporters. There's so many things which are created, so many contrivances in this film to stop us from getting to the plot points. Transporters don't work. So they have to use shuttlecraft. They get in the shuttlecraft, and Sulu has to shoot the shuttlecraft into the docking bay because the boring Klingons are trying to destroy Kirk to get honor or bounty or whatever. It's a confusing set piece because at that point in time, we have both Commander Klaw and Cybok as the bad guys. Who are we rooting for? But we have this weird set piece where the shuttlecraft goes inside the shuttle bay. And then we have Kirk fight Cybok on wires. Kirk is being lifted by Cybok because Cybok is a Vulcan. He's super strong. And can we also just say, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. But he lifts him and you can see the wires that Kirk is being suspended on. And Kirk loses again. He loses the fight again. Spock picks up the goofy rock gun, which they were fighting for. Kirk, run and get a phaser and stun them all. There's only like 10 guys in your shuttle. Call out to Scotty, who's watching all this. Do anything but fight this dude. And Scotty, if you're watching them fight, say, I should probably lock that door and put up a force field. No one does anything. And even Spock can't kill the guy with the rock gun. And it's a moment where it is so baffling, where Kirk is shouting, kill him, totally out of character. And Spock, He doesn't want to kill him. but can you at least wound him? Can you at least incapacitate him? It doesn't matter. He doesn't do it. And the other guys have McCoy and the rest of the crew as hostages. And so somehow they march through the ship with a skeleton crew. I grant you that. But even if it's 20 guys, you can close doors, right? You can keep people from coming up. They somehow overpower the Enterprise crew with their weird super soaker, like, space rock guns. No one ever tries to stop them. There could have been a great, like, corridor-by-corridor battle, even though a lot of those corridors were next-generation corridors. So already we have the little beef going still, right? But they get it. They're put in the brig. There's a brig scene. I don't know why would you put your guys in a brig? But that's when we finally find out that Cybok is Spock's half-brother. From a Vulcan priestess. Because, of course. Now, if we're going to lean into Michael Burnham being Spock's adoptive sister, we're going to have keep Cybok on the table, aren't we? We can't just ignore this movie anymore. Oddly enough, Discovery puts Star Trek V into play. The film, which has been mostly forgotten as far as canon, is suddenly and oddly put into play because of Discovery. You can't just hand wave that away if you're going to say, oh, well, Spock is my brother. He's my adopted brother. The idea of Cybok being his half-brother is not a great idea, and even Shatner was opposed to it. But for whatever reason, Paramount liked it, and so went forward. Let's move forward here. I'm going to the 58-minute moment. Oh, we skipped over so much bad stuff. Where Cybok finally tells everyone what he's after.
These are the questions which man has asked ever since he first gazed at the stars and dreamed. My Vulcan ancestors were ruled by their emotions. They felt with their hearts. They made love.
Lightsaber sound.
With their hearts. They believed with their hearts. But above all else, they believed in a place in which these questions of existence would be answered. Modern dogma tells us this place is a myth, a fantasy, concocted by pagans. It is no fantasy, I tell you. I tell you. It exists, my brothers. We have been chosen to undertake the greatest adventure of all time, the discovery of Shakari.
Is it possible?
Is what possible?
That he's found Shakari. The reason Cybok left Vulcan.
Our destination is the planet Shakari.
Cybok was crafted after Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, televangelists of the 80s by William Shatner, who was kind of drawn in by them. The problem with this caricature of this is that Cybok, the way he helps people is not a faith healing, but it's really good therapy. The idea of releasing people's pain. In no way is he a charlatan with the way he wants to release people's pain. And for most of the people that he affects, he has a definite effect. Now, to Shatner and to the writers, it appears that it's some sort of mind control. But to these other people, it certainly seems like good therapy. At least the foundation of therapy. And that's the thing which also bumps against me, is that what Cybok is doing, trying to get to someone's pain, trying to release someone to talk about your pain, is really a 21st century thing. 20th century would be like, no, keep your pain in, be stoic, bury it deep, and press forward. But what Cybok is espousing now is actually pretty sound. Cybok somehow has control over the entire crew by this point in time. Although it's hard to determine if he actually has control of them or not. Walter Koenig always kind of rationalized this by saying that he never fell under his spell. Cybok and the Emperor from Star Wars were always a little disappointing to me, because Isaac Asimov has a book called The Foundation. It's a series of books called The Foundation series. And he had a character in Foundation and Empire and Second Foundation that I loved. His name was the Mule, and this was a character that could come in and take over the minds of millions of people. He had this true psionic power, this true ability to manipulate people's minds, and he took over the entire galaxy. You basically unhinge. I'm sorry to be a spoiler, but it's really a great thing where he comes in and he just overtakes everyone. Cyborg Sir does this. I wish the Emperor in Star Wars would have basically manipulated the entire galaxy's mind with the power of the dark side of the Force. But here, it just seems as though he's a pretty good therapist who has talked to people and sort of convinced them that, yeah, why don't you talk about your pain? In this film, it is shown as an evil thing. And that's too bad. Because it also points to Shatner's aversion at every stage of this film from releasing his own pain, from going deeper in his character. All right, we have a jailbreak. James Doohan, Scotty, breaks them out and then bumps his head because he knows the ship like the back of his hand. Bonk. I remember they used that in the commercials, in the movie trailers for it. It always got a laugh because it's just good, funny, physical comedy. But it's not Scotty. And how does he know by the back of his hand? The whole place is falling apart. It's newly built. James Doohan did not want to do that scene. He had to do it 35 times, he said. It's a lot of head bumps. They get to the turbo shaft. Another regrettable scene. I think we've talked about this before, where they have to use Spock's rocket boots, and they ascend 78 floors, which we all know in the original series, there's only 24 decks. But Shatner really wanted to have 78 floors because that was dramatic. Even as they're shooting up, they pass by level 52 twice. It's just a bad sequence. And then they get back to the captain's lounge and they send a signal out. So out of all the things they can do, and certainly Captain Kirk has blown up his own ship to make sure people don't capture. He did it in Star Trek III. He threatened to do it in, Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. Great title, bad episode. He's willing to do anything. And the best he can do is call for help, is call the Federation and say, hey, my ship has been captured by a bunch of dudes with rock guns, and I'm on the ship now running around, and I have access to the computer. I can do anything I want here to stop them, and yet I'm just going to call for help. And again, even that, at that low level of effort, fails. Because the only person who hears it is Claw's second-in-command, this woman who has a Southern California accent and responds. So they're captured again, because instantly Cyborg people find them in the lounge. But this leads us again to the best scene. And I talked about this before. I've talked about how beautiful these scenes of where Cyborg gets these three characters, or two characters, to go through their pain. I want to play a little bit more of this McCoy scene. I know I've played it before, but you need to hear it again. Because McCoy is with his father, who's in terrible pain. And he puts in some weird device. And with the greatest amount of pain in McCoy's face, he terminates his father's life. And then he takes his father's face in his hands.
Preserve his dignity.
That wasn't the worst of it.
No, was it?
No!
Share it.
Not long after, they found a cure. A goddamn cure!
So if you hadn't killed him, he might have lived.
No! I love my father.
I released him.
Then you did what you thought was right.
Yes. No. Yes.
Release this pain.
Release it.
This pain has poisoned your soul for a long time. Now, you've taken the first step. The other steps, we'll take together.
That's good therapy. That's not bad. Talk about the things which are drilling deep down inside of you. This is a great scene from McCoy. Originally, DeForest Kelley did not want to do it because he felt he's been manipulated. And also, he didn't want to... His thought was, I would never go against Captain Kirk. I would never give in and side with someone else against Kirk. And so they had to talk to him about it. And Shatner finally came up with kind of a middle ground where McCoy was able to release this pain. He says it earlier, he says, God, no, please don't show me this. And he faces this. But then when the time comes, he stands with Kirk. It makes it a little weaker because they wanted to have Kirk stand alone against this guy. But it's also true to Star Trek. These two guys, none of the main cast of Star Trek would ever side against Captain Kirk. There's a deleted scene with Spock. I want to play a little bit of this, where in addition to him seeing his birth and his father proclaiming him to be so human.
Cyborg has failed. I resolved this pain long ago.
Spock. Spock! I must go! Now!
Cyborg! Wait!
I can't! They've banished me!
Take me with you!
No, you've chosen the Vulcan way.
I want to go with you!
It's not possible. I'm a heretic. I'm an enemy of the people. It would be dangerous for you.
But where will you go?
Where I can be free. Where I can prove I'm right. I will find Shakari.
That little snippet was omitted, and I'm sorry that it was. Probably was omitted because Leonard Nimoy made the choice to sound like a kid. Cyborg, don't go! And it doesn't land, does it? But it is a beautiful little scene where we have half-human Spock with his half-brother, Cyborg, and Michael Burnham nowhere to be seen. And he's leaving him. And he wants to go. And my God, it's so sad, isn't it? But we also understand this kind of brotherly love they have between them. And that Cyborg actually sacrifices himself for the family. He leaves because he would be branded as a heretic because he wants to find the Shakari. And he loves his brother, his half-brother, so much that he's willing to leave him. This actually makes Cyborg far more sympathetic. And it also establishes why he's going out to find this place. Because in the film, it's almost as though he stumbled across this idea. Like maybe he found it in some book 2 years ago. Shakari is like, oh, I'm going to find it. But he's wanted it all his life, even as kids. It's too bad they cut that scene, because it definitely adds a lot. As an overview, I want to say this also. Star Trek 1 and 2 are about Captain Kirk getting back the Enterprise, learning the loss of a friend. Star Trek 3 and 4 are about Spock, about him being dead, and then him coming back alive and learning what it means to be a human and a friend. Star Trek 5 and 6, to me, are about McCoy. Certainly Star Trek 6 has a lot more McCoy, and we'll talk about it as McCoy travels for the first time solo with Captain Kirk. But this one, it has the meatiest scenes for him when he's camping with Kirk and Spock, and when he has this beautiful scene here with his father. It's interesting how all six movies evenly distribute as far as who is the lead in that. Now, as I mentioned before, here comes this moment here where Kirk needs to confront his pain, but he doesn't. And it's right here.
Try to be open about this.
About what? I've made the wrong choices in my life? I turned left when I should have turned right? I know what my weaknesses are. I don't need Cyborg to take me on a tour of them.
If you just unbend and all...
And be brainwashed by this con man.
I was wrong. This con man took away my pain.
Damn it, Bones, you're a doctor. You know that pain and guilt can't be taken away with a wave of a magic wand. They're the things we carry with us, the things that make us who we are. If we lose them, we lose ourselves. I don't want my pain taken away. I need my pain.
Cyborg.
No. We need to see your pain. I know I've mentioned this before, but how wonderful it would be to see Kirk's pain. After all he's been through, losing his friend, losing his son, losing Edith Keeler, all of these things, what would be his pain? We've seen this in The Naked Time, when he laments about losing the Enterprise, about the fear of losing the Enterprise, and maybe that's his big pain. Or maybe in Star Trek V, it's about the idea of truly growing old. And not knowing what else is out there. Not knowing if there's a God beyond. Not knowing if there's a final frontier for him. Oh. If he could have just stepped away from the script. If someone could have plumbed those depths with him. What a richer film this would have been. William Shatner in this movie has a habit of stepping away from the limelight for the first time. Even though he's at the center of this film and allowing everyone else to have a spotlight. Throughout the film, all of his co-stars said he is a good director. He kept everything light and fun, and he was always so generous, but to a fault. Especially in the script writing, because at no point in time does he really step up and engage in his fears and his pains. In a film about fears and pains, he says that this is a con man who waves a magic wand by talking about your fears, by talking about your pain. It's too bad. It's too bad that we couldn't reopen this film. This film is fascinating because there are so many flaws in this gem of what it is. And this certainly is one of them. All right, so Cyborg needs this spaceship in order to penetrate the galactic barrier, this seemingly indestructible barrier at the center of the galaxy, which takes them very little time to get. Normally it would take them a couple hundred years. Like, it takes Voyager 78 years to cross the galaxy to get back to the Federation. But here, to get to the center of the galaxy, instead of taking 44 or 35 or whatever it is, it takes them about, like, 10 hours. So again, we have a problem here. And they just penetrate the galactic barrier with no problem, and with Kirk not even on the bridge. I should mention now about the special effects done by a company named Associates and Farron. They did Little Shop of Horrors. They did a couple other films. And ILM had been the special effects people they wanted to use, but ILM was busy doing other projects, like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. They didn't assign their A, B, or C team. They assigned their D team to work on Star Trek. And to their credit, Star Trek said no. So they went with these guys, this Associates and Farron, who were really big on putting dyes in water and making it look like clouds. And if you look at this film, there are lots of cool spaceship clouds in this. But then a lot of the spaceships themselves look terrible and are not moving and are lit kind of weird. And going through the galactic barrier, they go through a big cloud with a lot of bad lightning effects. And they get through pretty easy. There's no damage to the ship. Good on them. And you know what? The Klingon ship goes through too. And no one seems to notice that. Captain Kirk, as a prisoner, stands inside his captain's lounge. And after they get through the barrier, he just kind of walks onto the bridge. Again, he's not really fighting very hard to get control of his ship. Cyborg gives him back control of the ship at that point in time. He says, I made it. I made it to see Shakari. There it is. It's a big planet with a bunch of clouds around it. Good. Big blue clouds. You can have the ship back. So the hijacker gives Captain Kirk his ship back. And Captain Kirk does what? Does he put him in the brig? Does he arrest everyone? No, he keeps them on board on the bridge. And he takes Cyborg to the planet below. Because it's there. Shakari, when they land, looks surprisingly like Nimbus 3. Shakari, Nimbus 3, just with a pink filter on the camera. If this is truly heaven, it looks like a desert near Coachella. This is obviously because they had a desert near Coachella to work with, and so they ran around out there, and so instead of having a Garden of Eden, they had a desert planet. They spend a long time walking around the desert. The music's beautiful. Jerry Goldsmith does everything he can, but they spend a long time walking around the desert, finding nothing. And then at the last minute, day turns to night, and it also turns into a soundstage. And then God shows up in the middle of a slab of beef ribs, looking like rocks. God here also looks pretty terrible. He's a giant head. Many faces, one voice. This guy actually, the actor, was actually in a movie with William Shatner. I saw some of the footage called Crash in 1972. Not very good. ABC Movie of the Week or something like that. And proceeds to slowly sway everyone except for our intrepid Captain Kirk, who really only has one job in this entire film. He doesn't do anything except for ask one question. Let's get to that question.
You are the first to find me.
It kind of looks like Santa Claus.
Only your infinite wisdom.
And how did you breach the barrier?
With a starship.
This starship, could it carry my wisdom beyond the barrier?
It could, yes.
Then I shall make use of this starship.
It will be your chariot.
Excuse me.
It will carry my power to every corner of creation.
Excuse me, I'd just like to ask a question. What does God need with a starship?
Bring the ship closer.
I said, what does God need with a starship?
Oh, what does God need with a starship? Thank goodness he had been saving up all of his bad choices, all the times that he failed, to succeed at this one question. What does God need with a starship? This actor also played Admiral Hansen in The Best of Both Worlds in season 3. The battle does not go well, Picard. God is revealed very quickly as a rather dumb alien that coaxed Cybok all the way here, and as soon as he gets them really close, instead of using more mind powers or the power of persuasion or saying, oh, Will, I've been trapped here, my son, this is great, oh, I'm sorry, I don't remember who you are, but there's this barrier over me, my goodness, thank goodness, he just yells at them and threatens them and shoots lightning out of his eyes. Why not play the charade a little longer and then take the ship or take the shuttle? This is not a smart, non-corporeal entity or necessarily a powerful one, because if he wanted to smite Kirk, he just kind of like stuns him. He shoots him with lightning in his heart and Kirk gets right back up. Cybok soon realizes that this is not God. This is not the God of Shakari. It's no God. And his arc is complete. This is our character that we've been following in this entire film. All we're watching is Cybok. The rest of the characters are gently rowing down a stream, merrily, merrily, merrily. And Cybok completes his arc by sacrificing himself to save his brother, as he did a long time ago when they were kids, and he left. Again, what a great scene to have included to show how great Cybok was. You know, in the original series, we had arcs around guest stars, and that's fine. And that's why people compare this to a TOS episode, because it does circle around Cybok. And so finally, he sacrifices himself to, I don't know what they do. I mean, like, he could have probably just run off. They could have shot photon torpedoes at this creature anyways. The effect would have been the same. Everyone backs away. They shoot photon torpedoes. It goes, and then chases after them. It really didn't buy them anything. Nor do photon torpedoes work very well. Nor are they that powerful. They just destroy a little tiny part about 10 feet in circumference. they run away from this. And by the way, there is a great shot where they light a mesa in the distance as Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are running back to the shuttlecraft. It's like probably like a half mile away. It's beautiful. They just throw this giant pink light on this mesa in the distance, and it looks great. The dumb Klingon shows up and starts attacking the Enterprise, because why not? It basically attacks a picture of the Enterprise. I swear to you, they used a picture of the Enterprise as the bird of prey is approaching. The monster seems to get less and less powerful as chasing Kirk. They beam up the last two people, and Kirk's left alone with the monster. It attacks the shuttle. It can't get in the shuttle. It shoots lightning at him as he runs outside the shuttle. And then at the last minute, the Klingon ship shows up and shoots the alien with Star Wars special effects and kills God with phaser beams. It's a mess. This whole third act is a giant mess. Now, as I said before, Shatner tried to save his budget and get this great end scene, but they ran out of money. And one of the things he wanted to do is he wanted to have these rock monsters. It sounds dumb. These rock monsters come out of these giant stone barbecue ribs and attack them after they shot the photon torpedoes. But Paramount said no, they don't have the money for it. It didn't look good, but they did some test footage. Maybe I'll post that on the Facebook page. And at first I thought it looked dumb, like 5 or 10 years ago. But I look at it again, and they look pretty badass. I kind of wish they had them, these giant, weird-looking rock monsters, like chasing after Kirk, and they had to fight him and stuff. That would have been cool. They didn't have the money, didn't have the time. Instead, we have Kirk failing yet again and being saved by the Klingons. Of course, the Klingons are really... it's complicated, but Spock talks to Kord, who talks to Klaw, who gets them to beam them on the ship so that Spock can target the phasers to shoot the alien. And then Klaw apologizes. Oh, it's bad. It's bad. We have a little bit more of the episode where... St. John Talbot hooks up with Caitlin Dar because who cares? Klaw gives Kirk the honor sign. Everything's okay with them, even though it's not okay with the Klingons later on. Spock talks about Cybok. And then we get this last little bit here. Here we go. This is the end of the film, what it's all about. Oh, here comes Klaw. He comes up, gives the, honor. And Kirk walks over to his friends by the big ship wheel.
Cosmic thoughts, gentlemen?
We were speculating. Is God really out there?
Maybe he's not out there, Bones. Maybe he's right here. Human heart.
No. No, he's not. You see, Spock actually sighs a little bit. What a trite thing to say. He's in the human heart. What does that even mean? It doesn't really tag up with anything they were saying before. They're not looking for God. They weren't looking for God. It was Cybok who was looking for God. We have this other little tag, this little tie-up here, which also ties in.
Spock. I was thinking of Cybok. I've lost a brother.
Yes. I lost a brother once. I was lucky I got him back.
Oh. You mean your brother that you lost in Operation Annihilate? George Kirk? That's who you're talking about, right? You lost a brother? Not Spock. He's talking about Spock. But as we forget about Cybok, the half-brother, he forgets about the fact that he had a brother, which he kind of like totally swept under the rug, even in that episode. And his nephew, which we never talk about. It's one of those sloppy things, right? Where it's like, it's a nice sentiment, but at the same time, it's like, how could you not even remember that?
I thought you said men like us don't have families.
much wrong.
You're wrong about a lot of stuff in this movie. And we end the film with the three of them in sort of a nice little sequence here. Sitting around the campfire, he's playing his Vulcan lyre. In the subtitles, they call it a mandolin. It's not a mandolin. He comes in offbeat. McCoy doesn't sing. Then he starts to sing. And we leave on the worst musical number, and also the worst match shot as well. All right. I've taken up a lot of your time here. Let's get to some final thoughts here. My own thoughts about this film. Before we do that, I do want to share a couple of thoughts I have, a couple of thoughts you had from the Facebook page, if you'll allow me, because I forgot to do that last episode. If you go to the Facebook page, I will ask the question, Star Trek V was, and I'll sort of leave it out there. Oh my God, this is going to be the worst part of it, because I'm going to take the longest amount of time, but you've been here this long. You can listen to this part. I will say, Star Trek V made the lowest amount of money until Nemesis. It began, as Harv Bennett said, one of the things that worked against them for Star Trek V was the Next Generation. That, in some ways, it siphoned away some of the old crew's sort of specialness. And that is true. There's no question about that. But at the moment when Star Trek, the movie franchise, Star Trek, the original cast, need to be their strongest in order to assert their control and say, hey, that's great, you got a TV show, but we're the OG, and we're on movies, and you guys are on TV. They dropped the ball. They sang Row, Row, Row Your Boat instead of lifting up to the heavens. And as a result, the Next Generation became stronger and stronger. By the time they got to 6, everyone knew it would be their last film, when it could have gone on and on had that franchise been stronger. Let me read you a couple of the things here. Star Trek The Final Frontier, Kirk says, the autobiography, oh, let me see. Tony says, it's fun, ambitious, but kind of a mess. I agree. Jean Marie says, not as good as The Voyage Home. Aaron Mole says, don't get me wrong, it's a bad movie, but there's parts of it that are very Star Trek. John Riker, enjoyable despite its flaws. Rodney says, row, row, row your boat. Andy says, it was fun. Tony says, but a dream. Nicholas says, not the best. Maria Jose says, boring, confusing horses. That made me laugh. Zach says, on a mountain. And Roger says, embarrassing. I agree with all of your comments. Here's my pitch for how this film could have gone. William Shatner, Captain Kirk, tries to climb El Capitan. And he does fall. And he does fall and he is saved by Spock, or whatever happens. But at that point in time, he realizes that it is time to move on, maybe. That he has grown sold, and that all of his efforts to climb lead to nothing. It puts him in sort of a space of saying, maybe I should give it up. Maybe I am too old. He sees Cord being relegated to Nimbus 3, and he realizes this is the fate of all warriors. This is what's going to happen to him. And he gets so worried about it. At the end of the film, he does climb the mountain again. And at the top, who's there? To give him that final hand up, a hand reaches down and lifts him up. It's Spock and McCoy and Chekhov and Scotty and Uhura and Sulu. Because he's not going to die alone. And what he realizes is that he isn't alone, and then he has his friends with him, and that he can do this as long as he wants. That's one of my ideas. My second idea is that they should have pivoted hard and just made this an international spy, intergalactic spy thing where three of these guys were captured by Cybok, and you have Klingons and Romulans and humans all having to work together to save these three. It's like Mission Impossible. It would be so good. But you know what they did? They took those ideas, these failed ideas of having to rescue these hostages, otherwise a giant international incident would take place, and they put it into Star Trek VI. People say that the odd number of films are bad. The odd number of films inform the even numbers. Star Trek I was so bad and so amorphous that they made Star Trek II about concrete things, about a battle, about the characters. Star Trek III had the good idea of a heist. Star Trek IV used that for time travel, a time travel heist. Star Trek V had the ideas of galactic peace and a war that could be brewing through galactic intrigue. Star Trek VI took that and used the U.S. and the Russians as sort of an analogous situation. So Star Trek V, although it is flawed, it informed Star Trek VI, which then became a better movie as a result of it. As I said to you before, I did not watch this film in the theaters. I was graduating from high school and going to college when I heard that William Shatner was going to direct this film. And instinctively, I knew it was going to be bad. It's weird. It's like I had a spider sense, a Peter tingle, if you will. And I was like, this is going to be bad. Because even at that point in time, I knew that Shatner wasn't qualified to be a director. And so I was so worried about it. And sometimes you just don't, you want to avert your eyes from a train wreck. And so I did. And so I never saw it in the theaters. I never saw it on TV. I remember reading the Star Trek Compendium where they tried to kind of like say, it's pretty good, but it wasn't. And it wasn't until years and years and years later when I caught it on some random TV station and I watched it halfway through and saw Cybok, and I watched it all the way through and talked to Lawrence Luckinbill and then went to Yosemite and watched it again and then watched it twice for this, that I realized it's not as bad as I thought it was. It's also one of those movies where in your 20s you watch it and it's a train wreck, but in your 50s it becomes something different. I was going to start off this podcast by talking about how ridiculous it was, of William Shatner saying, I'm climbing up this mountain because it's there. How strange, how silly that is. And yet over the 4th of July weekend, I went out with my wife and kids to her family reunion. We went out to Southern California, down to San Diego, and I went for a hike. And as I was hiking through the mountains, there was a trail up to Mount Olympus. I kid you not, the place is called Mount Olympus. And I looked at it, and I went up it. And I climbed all the way up to the top, as high as I could go. And then later on, because there was a lake there, I went kayaking. I got in a kayak and a paddleboard, and I pushed off and I sat in the middle of the lake and I just enjoyed the quiet. And I realized that as much as I wanted to deride the fact that he climbs the mountain because it's there, and I have this whole time, it is kind of what men of a certain age do. We do find ourselves at this moment past our primes, perhaps, and looking ahead and saying, is that all there is? Is there nothing more? Where are the other mountains to climb, and what is beyond that? If we get to the top of the mountain, will we see God? Will we see ourselves? What will we find? And I'm also aware of the fact that I was in a boat, row, row, rowing my boat gently down the stream. So in the final estimation, maybe the final frontier is... Oh, I don't have anything good to end with this. I just wanted to tell you that. And maybe that's the point, is that Star Trek V doesn't really have the best end. But what are you going to do? Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. I'm Mike McCafferty. I just want to talk about Star Trek.